China's Communist Party prepares for a big anniversary tomorrow, 100 years of party rule. Festivity doesn't even begin to describe it.
Elaborate firework displays, light and drone shows, and even in space, two astronauts sent a video wishing the party a happy 100th birthday.
Also today on the show, Peru's recent presidential vote got ugly. Hate speech targeting the country's indigenous people.
I think this election tells us a lot about race. Race is always there in a latent way.
And for indigenous people in the U.S., a reassessment of their historic experience with racism.
Just in the last year since the murder of George Floyd, people are really more committed to looking at racism and examining this country's policies.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to have you with us. 100 years ago this month, 13 men, including Mao Zedong, met in a small room in Shanghai and changed the course of history. They founded the Communist Party of China. It marked a profound break from China's imperial and semi-colonial legacy. This year's centenary celebrations are trumpeting Communist Party rule not as a break from China's past, but a continuation of its long-storied history. The World's Rebecca Canther visited the site of the Communist Party's founding and has this report on the epic celebrations.
This summer in China, there's only one party worth talking about, the Communist Party. China's big on celebrations, and this one is no exception. School children in red scarves have been preparing communist songs. Propaganda posters and flags adorn the streets. Communist-themed museums and parks are opening. Mass weddings have been held. Elaborate firework displays, light and drone shows, and a military air show are planned. And even in space, a celebration at China's new space station. Three astronauts sent a video wishing the party a happy 100th birthday. In Shanghai, the hottest ticket in town might just be the site of that first Communist Party meeting back in 1921, and the new museum that's opened just across the street. The tiny room where it happened has been preserved. Now it's surrounded by a luxury shopping district, where expensive foreign brands, upscale restaurants, and fake historic architecture attract a bougie clientele. But in preparation for the anniversary, the area has been decked out in red, and nearby subway stops have been renamed for the occasion. Every morning, people wearing red and gold CPC pins on their lapels line up to visit the site. Many wear matching red T-shirts that say, "Follow the Party Forever," and hold little red flags. Everyone stops for a photo op in front of a big hammer and sickle outside the museum. Ms. Pan is leading a group from her office. It's the 100th birthday of the party, so our colleagues have come together on a field trip, she says. A whole day of events have been planned, starting with the museum and ending with an evening light show, she says. Inside the museum, tour guides with headsets shepherd huge groups around the exhibits. There are artifacts, clothes worn by the original delegates, manuscripts, old typewriters. The lights lower and visitors watch a hologram recreation of that first meeting, where delegates from around China gathered in secrecy to form the party. The emotional climax for many visitors is the chance to renew the vows they took when they joined the party. Groups recite the pledge together and then take photos with raised fists in front of a giant Chinese flag. A few steps away, they can enter a glass-enclosed booth to film their own private message. Wang Xiaotong is a party member and a volunteer at the museum. She says joining the party is a bit like converting to a religion, and that seeing the exhibit helps her better understand what Chinese people throughout history have struggled to achieve. They walked a challenging path, she says. The founders of the party really had a difficult time at the beginning, but they never gave up, she says. Learning about the history of the party makes her better appreciate how much the country has achieved today, she says. It's all leading up to a speech tomorrow by Xi Jinping, China's highest-ranking Communist Party official. Details of the day's events have been kept a tight secret. Tony Saich is a Harvard University professor and the author of a new book on the history of China's Communist Party. Observing from the United States, He says the anniversary celebrations are how China shows a strong image to its people and the world.
It's to sort of project that image across the nation of we are the legitimate rulers of China. We've done good by you. You should stick with us and you should have national pride in what we've achieved.
The message they want people to take away, he says, is that this is one party that won't be over anytime soon. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Some major developments in Myanmar today. The military government released more than 2,000 political prisoners. The government has been detaining activists and political opponents since the military seized power in a coup back in February. For more on today's news, we turn to Linda Lakdir. She's the legal advisor on Asia for Human Rights Watch. Linda, why now? What prompted this release?
It's not clear what prompted this release. It is possible that the growing international pressure made the junta feel that they needed to do something to try and show that they are being reasonable or responding. But I think it's actually very important that no one be fooled by this gesture, because while they may have released 2,000 people, they have more than 3,000 still in custody, and they are continuing to arrest people even as they let people go.
So politically, what does this mean in Myanmar right now? Does it signal any kind of shift?
Obviously, I'm very happy for all of those who've been released from detention and for their families. But I do not think that this is a sign that the military is changing their position. They are taking a very hard line on journalists. They literally issued a statement yesterday instructing journalists not to refer to them as a junta or to refer to it as a coup. Otherwise, they will be arrested and prosecuted. So they're not backing down. This is essentially just a recognition that the prisons are overcrowded with the thousands of people that they have arrested and that they needed to let some go in order to make room for the new arrestees.
You mentioned journalists. I mean, one person who's been released that many are talking about is Kay Zonwei. She's a reporter with the Myanmar Now News website. What do you know about her?
I mean, Kay Zonwei is, as you say, she's a multimedia reporter for Myanmar Now. She was arrested on February 27th and held for 127 days in prison. She was held in Insein prison, which is a prison in which conditions are notoriously terrible. And although we don't know much about, you know, what happened to her while she was there, it obviously would have been a pretty traumatic experience for her. But she is one of five journalists that we have been able to identify so far who have been released, but more than 50 journalists remain in prison.
Linda, how many more people are believed to still be in Myanmar's jails from this junta? And how much have you been able to learn about what conditions are like for them?
More than 3,000 people remain in prison that have been arrested since the military coup for opposing the coup. And what we have seen so far, what we've been able to find so far, is not only are conditions bad in the sense that food is terrible and all of those, but we have documented beatings. We have documented a mock burial of a 17-year-old. So conditions are appalling, and those who were detained are likely to have had some pretty traumatic experiences.
Yeah, for these detainees who've just been released, do you have any sense whether they'll continue with their activism? And a lot of testimony from Myanmar suggests many are willing to sacrifice their lives to rid the country of military rule.
I think it will be a personal choice for different people, and different people have a different tolerance for risk. I would not be surprised if they were required to say that they would not return to opposition to the coup or protest in order to be released. That may not stop some of them from going back to their activities. But as we've seen, it is a very persistent resistance in Myanmar, a lot of very, very brave people putting their life and their liberty on the line. And some of those released may put themselves right back on that line.
Linda, what will you be looking for to see just how real this release of detainees in Myanmar really is and what it says about the military regime in charge?
There's been no release of high-profile political figures that we have been able to see. Again, this is early days. It's going to take a while. And I think unless they start releasing major figures in the NLD, members of the National League for Democracy, or for heaven's sake, Aung San Suu Kyi and Win Myint, the president, this is not something that's going to show a major shift in their policy.
Linda Lakdir is the legal advisor on Asia for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much for sharing with us what you know.
Thank you for having me.
A big scandal is brewing in a country known for big scandals. Brazil is seeing fresh accusations of corruption and money laundering around the government's coronavirus vaccine rollout. The scandal may even go all the way to the top to Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro. Reporter Michael Fox has been following this. He joins us from Florianópolis, Brazil. There's been an ongoing Senate investigation of the government's handling of the pandemic, Michael. So lay out for us what's been going on.
Right. So we've been seeing this for about 2 months. The Senate investigation is supposed to go on for 90 days. They might extend it because of everything that's been happening. It was set up to really look into wrongdoing by the Bolsonaro government under this pandemic. And in particular, they were looking at failure by the government to purchase vaccines when they were offered early on, or reject vaccines when they were offered early on. They had found at the very beginning that there was at least 14 times that the Bolsonaro government either rejected offers or did not accept offers from pharmaceutical companies early on. In fact, some people said that Brazil could have been one of the first countries in the world to actually start vaccinating. And of course, we know that that definitely did not happen.
And in recent days, this has gotten pretty dramatic, I understand, with even President Bolsonaro being directly implicated now. How is he tied into this?
What we heard last Friday was a bit of a bombshell. You had two brothers by the name of Miranda, Luis and Ricardo Miranda. Luis is a congressman. Ricardo works, he's kind of the head of the import division at the Ministry of Health. And what they told the investigation was that they had uncovered a corruption scheme over the purchase of overpriced vaccines from a private Indian firm known as Bharat Biotech and a shell company based in Singapore. They had received a $45 million invoice from this offshore company in Singapore, and that had raised these red flags. And they say that Bolsonaro has knew about this, at least in March, when they raised their concerns with him in a private meeting. And basically what we saw last Friday was the members of the investigation were really trying to pin them down about who was at the head of this scheme. I think we might have a little bit of tape here.
A senhora também sabe buscar, que é o Ricardo Barros que o presidente falou.
Vamos buscar a verdade a favor do país.
Então o senhor confirma,
o senhor confirma então que
foi o Ricardo Barros que o presidente falou.
What we're hearing there are members of the Senate investigation, and they're pressuring Luis Miranda to name names, to tell who it was that Bolsonaro had mentioned when they met with him, who was kind of the head of this potential corruption scheme. And Luis Miranda, he's holding back tears as he finally says, yes, it was Ricardo Barros. It was Ricardo Barros. Ricardo Barros is Bolsonaro's top ally in Congress. He then goes on to say, listen, I would have named his name earlier, but I'm so afraid about what might happen to me because I'm pointing the finger at Bolsonaro. I'm saying that Bolsonaro actually knew about what was going down, and I know I'm going to get hit for it.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying, Michael, is that this first set of allegations of rejections of vaccines has now been overtaken by a much more insidious scheme that potentially goes all the way to Jair Bolsonaro, the president himself.
That's exactly it. What Luis Miranda says is that Bolsonaro knew about this and then did not actually take steps to stop it. It's an ongoing case. New revelations are happening every day. But this is what we know at this point. The other thing, though, is that Luis Miranda, who's now being treated as a whistleblower in this Senate investigation committee, he's talking about widespread corruption, not just this, but he's saying this is endemic within the Bolsonaro government. So this could really kind of open a massive can of worms in the Bolsonaro government at this point.
I mean, we've seen the impeachment of two Brazilian presidents, I don't know, in the past 10 years or so. What could all this mean for Bolsonaro now?
Well, it's not good. Remember, this comes just about a year out from next year's 2022 presidential elections. Bolsonaro, his approval rating is slipping right now. According to the latest polls, it's down around 23-24%. The news just over the last day says that as much as a third of his former supporters may have jumped ship and may now be supporting former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva for next year's presidential elections. And we also remember that Bolsonaro actually ran on a campaign of battling corruption. So it's kind of turning everything up onside its head. It is a bombshell that, you know, it's going to continue to hit the country for the weeks to come.
Michael Fox is a reporter based in Florianópolis, Brazil. Thank you for explaining this, Michael.
My pleasure.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. Peru held its presidential election nearly a month ago, and there's still no officially declared winner. Pedro Castillo, the rural school teacher and farmer candidate, appears to be ahead. That's in part because of overwhelming support from Peru's indigenous voters. As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, the election has been shining a light on a long history of discrimination against Peru's indigenous people.
To understand some of the reaction to Pedro Castillo, it helps to know a few things about him. He's from a northern region of the Peruvian Andes, and he speaks with the accent of the mountain farmer that he is. Castillo held a public breakfast in his farmhouse the morning of the election. He ate cornbread and chicken soup along with his parents, his wife, and kids.
Esta es mi casa, esta es mi herencia.
This is my house, this is my heritage, and this is my blood, Castillo said. He identifies as working class, though not necessarily as indigenous. But he and his supporters have been the subject of hate speech on social media. Marco Aviles is a Peruvian writer and academic who focuses on race.
I've never seen anything like this where people were like publicly saying, we should go into the towns and villages where people voted for Castillo, and we should go and rape the women. We should chastise these people.
Castillo's policies reflect a solidarity with indigenous Peruvians. Many of his critics have said he's a far-left communist who will seize private property. Aviles calls him a leftist conservative.
I mean, he is not for the rights of gay people, transsexual people. He's not for abortion. And he's also part of a party that declares publicly that it's like a Marxist and Leninist party.
The campaign for new president of Peru has brought to surface some of the country's racial and geographic divisions. Castillo's opponent, the conservative Keiko Fujimori, a Japanese-Peruvian woman, has also been the subject of hate speech.
I think this election tells us a lot about race. Race is always there in a latent way.
Juan Carlos Gallegos is an anthropologist and historian in the capital of Lima who focuses on race and ethnicity. He says racism is a legacy of Spanish colonialism and of intellectuals who up until World War II argued white Europeans were a superior race.
You could hear even in Peruvian Congress ideas that the Indians were basically beasts and not human. Yeah, believe it or not, there were intellectuals in Peru who said those things.
Gallego says that nowadays in Peru, it's impolite to speak about race, but that racism is normalized. Take, for example, mainstream comedy. Until recently, a white mestizo actor portrayed a television character known as La Paisana Jacinta,
which is a woman, an indigenous woman who is in the city, and she's depicted as someone without teeth, who is extremely dirty.
And there's El Negro Mama, portrayed by the same actor, except in blackface.
That shows this supposed Afro-Peruvian with animal-like features that walks like an ape.
Gallegos explains that in Peru, there are coded ways to speak about race. It's estimated that more than a quarter of the population is indigenous. And for example, it's considered pejorative to say someone is a serrano, or a person from the mountains, where a large portion of indigenous people live. Incidentally, that's where Castillo's opponents have claimed widespread voting fraud. Newton Mori Julca is a researcher at the Centro de Culturas Indígenas, an NGO that advocates for indigenous rights.
Es ahí donde nosotros señalamos de que se ha operado un mecanismo racista.
Mori Julca explains the voting fraud claims are racist because they focus on the majority indigenous regions of the Andes and Amazon and ignore the largely white mestizo cities. The U.S. State Department and other international observers have said they believe the election was clean. Voters in the mountains say they identify with Castillo, not necessarily because of his race. Juan Chilón is a farmer in Castillo's home province of Cajamarca.
Y entonces el Perú profundo, los pueblos originarios han votado por él porque se identifican con ese sentir.
Chilón says native people voted for Castillo because Castillo himself has experienced how the national government neglects deep rural Peru. And Chilón says in his native language Quechua that he's not worried about the racist discourse on social media.
Ama Yaquichu yanasa Jorge. Ama Yaquichu.
After all, Chilón says, Pedro Castillo may not be able to defeat racism, but he did very likely win the race. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Lima, Peru.
Let's not get too ahead of ourselves, but here in the U.S., life is starting to feel sort of normal. Fans at ball games, seeing movies in theaters, even going to concerts. It's times like these we learn to live again, an apt metaphor from the Foo Fighters there in concert last week at New York's Madison Square Garden for vaccinated fans. Yes, therein lies the key. If you were vaccinated, you could rock on in person. These amazing vaccines, and they are amazing, are allowing us to largely return to the way things used to be. That's exciting, but maybe you're still feeling a little weird about things. I know I am.
It's good to remind ourselves that all change is stressful.
Kara Sankonen is a psychiatric epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health. She researches traumatic stress and says even good change can be hard.
You know, feeling anxiety after not doing something or avoiding something for this, as long as we have 16, 17 months, that is normal for everyone. The real issue is if the anxiety is getting in the way of things you actually want to do.
Here's something all parents want to do, send the kids back to school. But Conan says also remember their feelings because the pandemic has been especially hard on kids.
What we've learned is there's really no replacing in-person contact between kids and teachers.
When the coronavirus first struck, schools simply were not prepared. With a year now of knowledge, Conan says communities need to do a better job getting ready for the students.
We can't just expect the schools to deal with kids' mental health without additional resources to do so.
There won't be quick fixes. It takes time getting used to the new way of doing things. Same goes for people returning to the office. Conan says there are just a lot of things that are out of our hands.
We like to feel like we're in control. We like to feel like we can predict the future. And I think with the challenges that we all are going to need to live with a certain amount of uncertainty.
Add in the Delta variant, ever-changing guidance on when and where to mask up. Conan says all of this uncertainty means it's even more important for governments to prioritize policies that support mental health. Conan spoke with the world for a live discussion this week about mental health and the pandemic. You can watch the video of the full conversation at theworld.org. Half of Australia's population is back under lockdown, and people are now questioning the country's long-term strategy of stay-at-home orders and closed borders.
The more the rest of the world opens up, the more obvious it will be that we're kind of isolated and we haven't got ourselves into a position of preparedness.
That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Record-breaking temperatures continue across the U.S. Pacific Northwest and along Canada's west coast. In Vancouver, British Columbia, emergency room visits have spiked. Dr. Daniel Kala told the CBC today that patients are unable to cope with the heat, and not just outdoors.
Some people outside, but I'd say more people were stuck indoors in their condos that weren't air-conditioned, and despite doing all the right things with ventilation and fans and cold showers, they just couldn't control their body temperature and they were still getting sick.
Heat is blamed for the deaths of more than 60 people in Vancouver since Friday. After breaking the 100-degree mark on Monday, temperatures are moderating, but it is still very hot as Canada looks to its national holiday tomorrow. Canada Day marks the day Canada became a country. Typically, it's celebrated like we do July 4th, with bands, fireworks, and kids singing the national anthem. But this year, dozens of communities have postponed or outright canceled Canada Day celebrations. This after hundreds of unmarked graves were discovered at former residential schools in Western Canada for Indigenous children, including another mass grave announced today that holds 182 human remains. Reporter Anita Elash has our story of how Canadians are dealing with their national holiday.
In the small town of Kispamsis, New Brunswick, on Canada's east coast, Canada Day is a big deal. Mayor Libby O'Hara says it's always been one of the highlights of the summer.
There would be bouncy castles, there would be bands playing, there would be cupcakes, there would be fire trucks spraying water, there would be games set up for kids to win prizes.
This year, the town was planning a smaller party so people could still social distance. But that all changed last week after the second discovery in a month of unmarked graves at a former residential school. The party was cancelled.
As a parent and a former educator, I couldn't imagine children being torn out of the arms of their parents, never to return. And that hit a chord with me that it broke my heart.
In Melville, Saskatchewan, the town council voted to postpone this year's socially distanced parade and fireworks. the largest burial site discovered this month at the Cowessess First Nation, is just a short drive away. Walter Strelaski is Melville's mayor.
This is our neighbor. And, you know, we take the attitude that neighbors are very of great value to us. They hurt. We were hurting, too.
There have been calls to cancel Canada Day before. Critics say it celebrates the formation of a country built by taking land from Indigenous people. But this is the first year those calls have been explicitly tied to the legacy of residential schools for Indigenous children.
I think this Canada Day is a reckoning.
Nagusset, who goes by just one name, is executive director of the Native Women's Shelter in Montreal. She's leading a march through the city tomorrow to honour Indigenous children.
I think this Canada Day, you need to understand what Canada, that you sit, you know, sort of on the backs of Indigenous people and broken sort of treaties and, you know, a lot of trauma and oppression.
She says Canadians should stay home on Canada Day and read the report from Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, published 6 years ago. Only a handful of the Commission's 94 recommendations have been implemented.
You have to do some work and you have to make some kind of change to acknowledge that we have so many obstacles.
The National Canada Day celebration is going ahead, so are many local ones. Ellis Ross argues canceling Canada Day is a missed opportunity.
Canada is just really starting to wake up to its dark history. But you know what? Every country has a dark history. Every single country.
Ross is a former chief counselor of the Haisla Nation and a member of the Legislative Assembly in British Columbia. His parents were both sent to residential schools. He says they would want all Canadians to know about the hardships at the schools, but also what they learned there and how they succeeded afterward. He says that instead of canceling Canada Day celebrations, they should adapt to include stories like those.
For the first time in my lifetime, non-Aboriginals want to be with Aboriginals and mourn with them, and they want to learn more. And what better way to symbolize this in a nationwide gathering or a province-wide gathering?
In places like Melville and Kispamsis, non-Indigenous community leaders are just beginning to grapple with how they can reconcile Canada's colonial legacy with their own experience of the country. Melville's mayor, Walter Strelaski, says he'll take Canada Day to reflect.
I'm a Canadian. I love my country. We have a lot of freedoms. There were mistakes made, but we have great and wonderful things in this country, and that's how I'm going to celebrate my Canada Day.
The town council has asked residents to honour their Indigenous neighbours today by lighting candles and displaying the colour orange, a symbol of residential school survivors. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
Here in the U.S., there is also a push to establish something similar to Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As Emily Schwing reports, there are lessons to draw from Canada's experience. And a warning, the story describes traumatic events. Please take care and of those around you while listening.
The U.S. government funded more than 350 boarding schools for Indigenous children from the 1860s until the 1960s.
We need a commission here in the United States to address the same policies and experiences and impacts that we had as Canada.
Christine Dindisi McCleave is the CEO of the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. She helped draft a bill that was introduced in the U.S. House last fall. It called on Congress to establish a Truth and Healing Commission on Indian boarding school policy. The bill was forwarded to two committees, but hasn't moved since.
I think the reason it didn't go anywhere is because there was a lot going on politically.
Dindisi McCleave, who's Turtle Mountain Ojibwe, has family members who were forced to attend Indigenous boarding schools in the U.S.
This was not a priority. And just in the last year since the murder of George Floyd, people are really more committed now to looking at racism and examining this country's history and examining its policies that were racist or genocidal.
Let's start thinking about why we were sent to these places.
Jim LaBelle Sr. is a survivor of the boarding school system in the U.S. And the answer to his question, why was he sent to boarding school, is simple. LaBelle Sr. is Alaska Native. Today, he's a board member for the Boarding School Healing Coalition. At a coffee shop in Anchorage, LaBelle Sr. talks about what happened when he first arrived at the Wrangell Institute back in 1955. It was a government-funded boarding school for indigenous children in southeast Alaska.
The first order of the day was to strip naked. Some children who did not understand the commands infuriated some of the matrons, who ran over and just literally tore their shirts off of them or their pants until they were naked.
LaBelle first went to the Wrangell Institute when he was 8.
I can still remember a time when a matron ran in and he took a floor brush and he rubbed some lye soap on this floor brush and proceeded to brush this kid vigorously until he bled. Parts of his skin were falling off.
Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Committee collected testimony from nearly 7,000 survivors who told of rampant sexual abuse, physical violence, and malnutrition. American boarding school survivors, like Jim LaBelle Sr., tell the same kinds of stories. But south of the 49th parallel, there's no commission to examine the policies or collect archival records to preserve the history.
These are historically milestone events. They can't be addressed lightly and expected to be done thoroughly.
Raymond Frogner says Canada's commission collected more than 5 million records. He's the head of archives for the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg.
One of the successes was that the TRC did have a mandate from the Supreme Court to go and request these records. One of the weaknesses was they were given a mandate to create as complete an historical record as possible, but that was never fleshed out. That definition was never explained.
Discoveries this month of hundreds of unmarked graves on the grounds of former residential schools in British Columbia and Saskatchewan have raised questions about how thorough the TRC was in investigating Canada's boarding school system. Frogner says the TRC did identify at least 400 unmarked grave sites across the country.
But they quite literally ran out of resources.
Back in the U.S., there's an effort this year to revive that bill that aims to establish an American commission similar to Canada's. One difference? Christine Dindisi McCleave says reconciliation won't be part of the commission's title.
Reconciliation is really a colonized term. A lot of people argue that we can't have reconciliation when things weren't conciliatory from the beginning. And so really what we are looking for is, first of all, the truth, and then some form of justice, and then we can have healing.
This spring, more than 200 people responded to a survey with recommendations on how to redraft the bill. They emphasized the need for long-term funding and the importance of collecting the records that hold the truth about what took place in America's Indigenous boarding schools. For The World, I'm Emily Schwing.
In Australia, almost half the population is again under lockdown, another lockdown after a year of Australia's strict zero-tolerance policy to beat back the coronavirus. Catherine Bennett is a professor and chair of epidemiology at Deakin University in Australia. She joins us from Melbourne. So, Catherine, for the past year, Australia has been largely successful at keeping COVID rates and COVID deaths down with the zero-tolerance approach, just slightly over 30,000 cases total, which is pretty remarkable. Briefly explain what that approach has been.
It started off with, you know, it was a heavy suppression strategy. We didn't want to overwhelm our hospitals. We wanted to try and keep infections under control. And so the effort really then went into making sure we'd closed our borders fast and early. And in doing so, you know, we had to then keep strengthening the borders because you would find weaknesses. Somehow the infection would cross into the community. We'd have to work hard to contact trace, you know, isolate, close that down. And so progressively over time, we became better at it. We haven't got ideal quarantine facilities. We use hotels. There's been some issues around that. But we wound up putting such an investment into the borders that then became the priority, you know. And so it actually moved from a suppression strategy to hold things at bay to prevent serious illness and death until we had the vaccine, if we could get a vaccine. That's meant that there's a proportion of the population who believe that we can just keep the borders closed. We'll just stay like this. And clearly, these variants are not allowing that.
I mean, it's striking. Only about 5% of Australians have been vaccinated, which is really low, given that Australia is a wealthy country with a fairly small population. Why is that? Is it hesitancy, or do you not have enough vaccines?
It's a combination of all of the above. We did go later than the rest of the world. We did have the privilege of time where we could wait till all the safety data was in the first, you know, formal trial reports for the full 6 months. And that gave us the chance to then go through our regulatory processes in January this year. By the time we actually started the rollout, we had two main choices initially. Pfizer, where we did have a limited supply, but over time would build. And we had AstraZeneca, which included some offshore supply, but also we had the capacity to make that onshore. But then obviously the complications with those very rare side effects meant, well, if we've got the choice, then we try and focus our Pfizer for the younger adults where there's a lower risk. We actually rolled out through general practitioners in the community rather than mass vaccination centres. And we still had a problem with supply for quite some time. So we had a strategy which we started to roll out, but this sort of lack of sense of urgency and the complication in the rollout system, and then some confusion around possible risks and a lot of misinformation that's circulating out there, actually just, I think, contributed to slowing this down further.
I'm wondering if you think the zero tolerance policy was so successful that maybe that's also why people have been hesitant to get the vaccine. Like, why do I need a vaccine when there's very little COVID here?
That's right. And that's what we're hearing. And there are people that actually think closed international borders just means you can't go on an international holiday. But that's not what this is about. This is much larger than that in terms of the impact of family separated, people moving for work and study, and our whole, you know, international enterprise. And the more the rest of the world opens up, the more obvious it will be that we're kind of isolated and we haven't got ourselves into a position of preparedness, including our vaccination coverage, to enable us to say, you know, we'll join in. So it's a difficult time. I think it's made the sort of notion that we need to live with a virus down the track difficult for some people and something they'd prefer to avoid, and possibly in some ways worse than it needs to be. I think people know the seriousness of COVID in other countries, and that's motivated them to be vaccinated. But here, a lot of the lockdowns reinforce this kind of, you know, fear of this virus and what it might do, and the language that's often used to explain and to reinforce serious and heavy restrictions put in place is quite alarming. It's talking about wildly infectious viruses and the risk of, you know, cases exploding and the deaths that will follow. And so people hear that, and the idea then that you might live with that virus can be quite intimidating and scary.
So what is an alternative approach to the zero tolerance policy?
We need to have the plan to say how we're going to transition out of this, and we need to have the public involved in that. At the moment, people will make a comment like, you know, we have to open up. There will be some people who die. Then there's 3 weeks of shock horror that, you know, because no death is acceptable. But of course, you know, usually when we have these conversations about health and investment in prevention, it's we're losing this many people. How much can we afford to spend to try and save more lives?
What strategy would Australia transition to, though? I mean, the Delta variant, as we've seen in many places, it's just ratcheted up pressure on health systems.
It has, but it's about having the vaccination coverage that helps prevent against a serious disease. It means you actually have to have a strategy that says, well, maybe we don't try and keep all coronavirus at the border, but maybe we start to really monitor for variants of concern so that we're then in a position to try and test, trace and isolate those rather than any version that comes across the border. The trouble is we're seeing everything take over so quickly. You get a more transmissible strain and it quickly dominates the entire globe. But at the same time, the other way of looking at the overwhelming is to say, if every time we get one case, we have to go into lockdown, it has so many other health impacts that, you know, you've got to weigh that up differently. And so if, in fact, you know, you've got a very transmissible virus, but we can contain the impact it has on morbidity and mortality through vaccination, then we still need to hold it off for as long as we can to get the vaccination rates up.
Right. At this point, Catherine, is the COVID vaccine widely available to Australians and are they lining up for it?
So it's hard to gauge from some of the public commentary. It's a matter of rolling it out in terms of the availability, but also it is about the Pfizer supply. And we're getting supply in, and the supply is gradually getting bigger, but we won't get a decent supply where our supply beats demand until September, probably October, November.
That's a lot of time. I mean, how concerned are you that Australia is going to be overwhelmed by the Delta variant?
Well, that is a great concern, and I think that's why everyone's watching these current clusters so carefully. And this is the first time we've seen it, this sort of complexity of different outbreaks overlapping at the same time. Where we looked 3 months ago was very different to where we are now. And I think it's made people realize it's a race.
Catherine Bennett is the chair of epidemiology at Deakin University in Australia. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
U.S. forces officially withdrew from Iraq a decade ago, but American airstrikes are still happening there. The latest came on Sunday, targeting Iranian-backed militias in both Iraq and Syria. Then on Monday, U.S. troops in Syria came under rocket fire. The back and forth highlights some key challenges for the Biden administration: how to thwart Iran, avoid an escalation of fighting, respect Iraq's sovereignty, and bringing an end to these so-called forever wars. To unpack all of this, we're joined by Marcin Alshamari. She's a fellow with the Brookings Institute and joins us from Baghdad. Marcin, what are the U.S. options in Iraq? The U.S. has a small contingency of American troops there, certainly not the same presence militarily it had 10 years ago. How can the U.S. achieve its goals in the region?
Well, the U.S.'s goals in the region right now are really to counter ISIS, and it has a very small force to do so. I mean, 2,500 troops is what we're left with, and they're there at the invitation of the Iraqi government, hosted at Iraqi bases. So the U.S. is in agreement with the Iraqi government over the shared goal. But, you know, the broader issue with the U.S. in the Middle East right now is this fight against ISIS is also coming up against this need to confront Iran. Where this gets complicated is that some of Iran's allied paramilitary groups were also involved in the fight against ISIS, but continued to exist afterwards. And so it left the U.S. in this position where it has to confront two completely different sets of enemies, one of which it shares with the Iraqi government, ISIS, but the other one in which it shares a very complicated relationship with the Iraqi government. And so the U.S.'s options are quite limited, and they have been following a fairly usual pattern of escalatory behavior between U.S. and Iran, but is usually reciprocal.
And what is the evidence these militias in this area are in fact connected to Iran?
So these groups are entirely composed of Iraqi individuals, have ties to Iraqi politicians, to the Iraqi state. It's very complicated to say that they're backed by Iran completely or they're not. A lot of the times they do receive funding from the Iraqi government because they are actually officially part of the security forces. It's a very difficult thing to say that the entirety of them is Iranian backed. And the evidence really comes from the kind of statements they make in terms of espousing an ideology of resistance that is also espoused by Iran and by other Iranian allied groups. But really, you can't strip them of their independence in some ways. The prime minister himself, Mustafa al-Kadhimi.
Iraq's prime minister, yeah.
Yes, he's frequently tried to confront them and has backed away. And the day before these airstrikes happened, he was actually at the parade commemorating their anniversary, saying positive things about them, taking photos with them. He has to be there. The relationship is extremely complicated.
How are Iraqi authorities responding to U.S. attacks on their soil and the ensuing back and forth with these militias?
You know, the Iraqi public and the Iraqi officials are both fed up with this. But this time around, it's even more difficult for the Iraqi government because this actually happened as Iraq was hosting a summit with the Jordanian king and with the Egyptian president, who are in Baghdad to discuss economic relationships and ties and development. And amidst this moment in which Baghdad was trying to portray itself as a stable force in the region, as a sovereign state in the region, an attack on Iraqi sovereignty happens by Iraq's ally, the United States. It just doesn't look good for the Iraqi government. And it was one of the few times that the Iraqi government actually came out and said something against the U.S. airstrikes, condemning the attack on their sovereignty.
Mm. And where do those Iraqi authorities stand on these Iranian-backed militias within their borders? I mean, especially now as those militias are vowing revenge on American troops.
On one hand, these paramilitary groups are composed entirely of Iraqi individuals. So when they're killed, you can imagine that some parts of public opinion will become anti-American for this happening. At the same time, there was a lot of public dissatisfaction with these militias, particularly the protests in which a lot of the civil activists and protesters saw them as being directly involved in the killing of protesters. And so their popularity is severely on the decline. The Iraqi government is trying to detangle these relationships, trying to preserve the sovereignty of the state, the security forces' monopoly on violence without triggering a civil war is an extremely complicated thing to do.
Marcin, you're there in Baghdad. What does it mean to the people of Iraq that it looks like the White House wants to end the war in Afghanistan, but still somehow want to be involved in Iraq? Is that confusing when Joe Biden is talking about ending forever wars?
Iraqis right now aren't particularly attentive to American politics elsewhere. They're focused on what's going on in Iraq. And to them, given the precedent of 2003, how big that was, the precedent of American involvement in the country, they don't really see the U.S. as ever really leaving Iraq in any meaningful way. And they see the story of the United States' involvement in Iraq and Iran's involvement in Iraq as a permanent fixture that they have to contend with.
Marcin Alshamari is a fellow with the Brookings Institute, speaking with us about the latest U.S. strikes in Iraq and Syria. She joined us from Baghdad. Marcin, thank you very much for explaining what's going on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Earlier this hour, The World's Rebecca Kanther reported on China's celebrations for the 100th anniversary of the country's Communist Party. Join us tomorrow on the show for a look at China's dramatic rise in global power over the past century. That's tomorrow here on The World.
Pasaste a mi lado.
The voice of Pedro Infante, actor and singer. He was known by some as the Frank Sinatra of Mexico. Mourned by fans when he died in a plane crash in 1957 in the Yucatan. His voice lived on, though. This is one of Infante's most beloved songs, Cien Años, 100 Years. Here, the song was featured in a 1954 film Pedro Infante starred in, Cuidado con el Amor, or Watch Out for Love.
Y toda mi amargura se ahogó dentro de mí.
Now the song is getting a reboot. Award-winning Mexican singer Natalia Lafourcade has just released her own updated version of the classic tune for The Brokenhearted.
Pasaste a mi lado con gran indiferencia.
But Lafourcade turned the song into a duet with Mexican-American vocalist Pepe Aguilar. I guess that way we're not really certain who got their heart broken and who's going to be thinking about the other for 100 years.
Me duele hasta la vida, saber que me olvidaste, pensar que mi desprecio merezca yo de ti.
An equal opportunity breakup song there from Natalia Lafourcade and Pepe Aguilar. We've also got to call it quits, just for the rest of the day, though, or let's stay together online at theworld.org. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.